Our guest this hour does not arrive with a happy story, but certainly a well-told one. It's the story of a troubled young woman who took her life more than two decades ago. The young woman was Michelle, the niece of Alice Talmadge of Springfield. Alice felt the need to tell Michelle's story, felt the need strongly enough to write a memoir called Now I Can See the Moon, a story of a social panic, false memories, and a life cut short. Alice Talmadge got a master's degree from the University of Oregon School of Journalism, and she's been reporting, writing, and editing ever since. Her career includes a stint as a correspondent for the Oregonian and a period as an adjunct instructor at the U of O. Alice Talmadge, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
One thing stood out in your list of works, and that's a 1998 guidebook for juvenile sex offenders called Tell It Like It Is. How did that project get started?
Well, I talk about that in the book somewhat. I was editor for a monthly newsletter for teens in foster care, and I became aware of kind of just the whole sexual abuse prevalence that ran through the society, and we used a peer-to-peer approach in the newsletter where I would interview teens and print their stories, so it wasn't adults telling foster teens how to make it in the real world. It was teens telling other teens their stories, and when the situation with Michelle happened, after she died, I was very much floundering, and the idea came to me that I needed to know more about perpetrators, about predominantly males who had victimized girls or women. I had been on the side of the victims pretty much my whole reporting life, and I became interested in the other side of things. And so I put those two experiences together and came up with the idea for that book.
So there's a lot to unpack in this book, Now I Can See the Moon, because it is it does get into the realm of sexual abuse and whether it happened or not. So there's a lot of stuff in here. The author's note is very clear. This is a memoir. It is subjective. I mean, were you concerned that you would get some flaming from people about what you're writing about here?
Did you say, did I expect to have some flaming?
Were you concerned? Yes.
Yes, I was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so the center of the story is your niece, Michelle, who committed suicide. What led up to it? What was the immediate set of circumstances?
Michelle had been emotionally troubled for a long time, starting in probably middle school and all the way through high school. She had severe, severe bulimia that she could not get a handle on except for at rare moments. And along with that, she had, you know, an emotional illness that was never adequately diagnosed or defined. And she had had some breakdowns, and she was quite emotionally vulnerable. And in 1989, she got caught up in the narrative of ritual abuse and came to believe that she had been ritually abused throughout her childhood by members of a satanic cult. And she believed that she would have memories relating to that abuse. She called them flashbacks, and they were very intense and destabilized her even more. And as those memories intensified, she became more and more restless. She could not be still. She ran away from the hospitals where she had been admitted. She just got very ill, and she ended up taking her own life 2 years later.
When she began to talk about the flashbacks, did a split develop in her family over whether her memories were real or not?
Her mom ended up fairly quickly believing Michelle's memories, and ended up believing that that whole narrative was true, that there was a nefarious cult operating throughout all echelons of society and throughout the country, and she was very, very disturbed and upset about that. And what I found out much later, you know, at the time I thought she was, you know, not nuts, but I thought that she and Michelle were outliers. But what I found out later is that this belief and this narrative was very prevalent in areas around the country. They were not alone.
So let's talk about that societal context at the time. This is the 80s into the 90s, and was it really it sounds like a bit of conspiracy theory in there as well, that was ritualized, and was it believed to be some sort of national cult or something?
I think the way paranoia and rumor works is that there's a little bit of haziness as to exactly what the cult was and who belonged to it and how many victims there were. And it was the kind of exaggerated terribleness of victims' reports that people focused on. You might remember that in that period, in the mid-1980s, there were us in about a dozen communities around the country where daycare workers were accused of really heinous sexual abuse of their child charges. And a lot of that extreme abuse included ritual abuse, the same kind of narrative. So that was nationwide and, you know, in communities, in select communities around the country. And some people believed that this cult activity was generational in families, and others believed that, you know, it was the cult was independent. But as I said, the facts were hazy because there weren't any facts.
Right. In a lot of cases, certainly there weren't. We're talking about Alice Talmadge's memoir, Now I Can See the Moon, a story of a social panic, false memories, and a life cut short, the life being that of Alice's niece, Michelle, who died in Utah many years ago. We'll come back and talk more with Alice about what the circumstances were for Michelle personally and what the broader societal context was at that time as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Alice Talmadge, a long-traveled journalist from Springfield, graduate of the University of Oregon master's degree program and occasional teacher there as well. She's written a memoir, but it really focuses on her late niece, Michelle. The book is called Now I Can See the Moon, a story of a social panic, false memories, and a life cut short as Michelle committed suicide in her 20s. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we get further into the subject matter here. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we've established that among the things that Michelle was talking about was that she had been a victim of ritual sexual abuse from some sort of cult, which was happening a lot. People were reporting that a lot at this period in time in the 80s and 90s. I have to believe, Alice, this is a bit of a minefield to get into discussing this, because you want people to tell honestly what happened to them, and you want to believe them when they do, but there are a lot of stories that turned out not to be true. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. And it was, and as I talk about in the book, I had worked at one of the first battered women's shelters in the mid-1970s. And back then, the whole idea of spouse abuse and domestic violence was just emerging, because it just was not talked about. And we were instructed to believe women when they told their stories, because nobody else believed them. Their families didn't believe them. The courts didn't believe them. The police didn't believe them. So that had been kind of instilled in me. And so when this situation came up, even though it was just bizarre and out of any frame of rational possibility that I possessed, I couldn't just outright challenge my niece and her memories. I just was unable to do that.
You write that Michelle's suicide was an act of utter surrender. To what or to whom?
I just feel that she felt there. You know, it was so much of what we live for is hope, and I just felt she had lost all hope for herself. She could not exist in her in her world, in her mental world, that she couldn't get out of it. She couldn't get outside of it.
Take us back to her beginning. You gave us a sketch of what she was like in her adolescent years with bulimia and some emotional illness, and then, of course, this belief that a satanic cult was abusing her. But you write that she was born under a difficult star. In what sense?
Well, what I meant by that is, you know, 1968 was a really tumultuous time in our culture. I think she was born between the assassinations of Dr. Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy were very close to when she was born. And her mother had severe postpartum, what we call now severe postpartum depression, after she was born. And so there was that to deal with. So it was just, and the culture as a whole was just divisive, and there was confrontations over the war and the draft, and women's liberation was coming to the fore. It was just a very, you know, trying time for the culture as a whole.
Yeah, I should point out, too, that in recent years, as people have talked about the upheaval in American society at the moment, a lot of them go back and say, wow, this seems crazier than 1968.
Yes.
So 68 is always the benchmark year, and of course, that was the year that Michelle was born. How much were you around Michelle in her formative years?
Not very much. I first started visiting the family, I think, when she was 6 or 7. I was living in Boston at the time and kind of needed an escape, so I drove there. And I moved out west in the late 1970s, and then I started visiting them almost yearly in the summer, but just for a week or at a time. And then there was one summer and fall where I spent about 3 months with the family. And that was very formative for our relationship.
That was your chance to bond, in essence?
Yes.
So, you know, as the outsider coming in, did you have something of an easier time forming a connection with her that was different from what she had on a daily basis with her sister and brother and parents?
I think so. I think Michelle felt herself to be an outsider, and I think she appreciated the fact that I kind of marched to my own drummer, so to speak, or to her, that's what it seemed like. I think there was a lot of us who were wandering at that time. And so, yeah, she felt safe with me, and I wasn't a parental figure. I didn't try and corral her or set her straight or anything like that. We were more kind of buddies.
We're talking to Alice Talmadge from Springfield about her niece Michelle, who is the focus of her memoir, Now I Can See the Moon, a story of social panic, false memories, and a life cut short. Michelle sounds like a very intelligent kid. She had some talents. Tell us about those.
Oh, she was, of course, you know, we bonded a lot. She, her mom and I and Michelle would sit around the kitchen and talk about books a lot. They were both avid readers and had great insight and appreciation of good writing. And Michelle herself, of course, I'm biased, but I just thought she was a beautiful writer, very, very evocative, very honest about her feelings and was able to express them. And she was also a clarinetist. She played the clarinet very well.
Huh. Her mother described her as askew in her adolescence. Interesting way to put it, but when she was talking about it, what did she mean?
I'm sorry, you said her mother described her as what?
Askew. A-S-K-E-W, askew?
Oh, askew. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, you know, it wasn't until I started interviewing her parents when I wanted to write this book that I learned this, but very early on, I guess Michelle kind of was a disruptive personality in the family and would say things and react in ways that just kind of took her parents aback, and they really weren't sure how to handle it. So, yeah, that's what Mary meant by askew.
And I should point out, your brother is John, Michelle's father, sister-in-law, mm-hmm. Mary. And so I was going to ask you about their you do dedicate the book to them, so I assume that they were going along with you in writing it. Was there any dust up at the beginning about you want to do what?
No, I think when I very the first time I approached them, it was almost like, you know, when you a release valve to a channel or a vein. I mean, they just spilled out with all these stories and all this feeling because they had been very private those years about what was going on, and it was incredibly stressful. And they were in territory that, well, nobody knew how to navigate it, and they were living with this situation that they didn't have the tools to cope and or didn't feel like they did, except for love, which they had. And
It sounds like a lot of this discovery with them took place, what, 20 years after Michelle was gone?
A lot of the what?
A lot of the stuff you discovered, it sounds like, with them came on about 20 years after Michelle had died.
Right, yeah. And I started, you know, talking and finding out more about her childhood and how there were kind of just, you know, social adjustment problems from early on. And then they just kind of kept going and got more intense as she grew older.
There are passages from Michelle's journals quoted at length in Now I Can See the Moon. Did she share those in life, or those were just things she left behind?
No, there were the things that she left behind. Her mom shared that journal with me.
Mm-hmm. And was that some part of the discovery process we were just talking about, that you've got to see these 20 years later?
Yes, very much so.
What was that like, looking at those for the first time?
Oh, heartrending. Heartrending because, you know, earlier journals, like from 1968, she was deep in the throes of bulimia, but she was otherwise together and she expressed her loneliness and her feelings of isolation so beautifully. In her later journals, where she also expressed how she was feeling, her mental state was much more fractured, and those were just heartrending to read. But the earlier ones, they were heartrending as well, but I still felt that they reflected the Michelle that I knew.
We're talking to Alice Talmadge of Springfield about her memoir about her niece, which is called Now I Can See the Moon, a story of social panic, false memories, and a life cut short. If you have something you'd like to add to the conversation or some questions to ask of Alice, feel free to join us on the Jefferson Exchange. By phone, it's 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Let's go a little further back, get a little more context for Michelle. She grew up in Logan, Utah. Is that right?
Yes.
Mormonism a big factor in the family?
Yes. Mm-hmm. My brother converted, and the family is deeply, devoutly Mormon.
Mm-hmm. But he came from, sounds like a church-attending Catholic family in your
yes.
childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did you and Michelle ever, how deep did your conversations get? It sounds like you were kindred spirits. I just wonder how much you talked about, you know, life and religion and some of the deeper things other than, gee, my hair's feeling this way today or that kind of stuff.
She was never shallow. She just went right for it. Not just with me, but, you know, people who have contacted me since writing the book. Remember her from high school and in her later adolescence, and she stood out for them for the same reasons that she stood out for me, is I never watered anything down. I didn't talk to her like a kid. We talked about life. We talked about not fitting in. She talked about problems with her parents and her siblings and herself. And she just didn't do shallow.
So was she too deep for some of the kids around her? It sounds like this is the kind of person who would be thinking a little harder than perhaps the average high school student.
Yeah, you know, I I can't really respond to that because I wasn't around, but she did have all I know is that she often complained about not being able to sustain relationships, and I don't know if that was due to this temperamental quality that she had, this emotional volatility that showed itself even back then, or if she was too precocious for her peer group. I just don't know.
Did she have a level of respect for you in which she didn't go through some of these emotional blow-ups that she was known for in the immediate family? Did she treat you differently in how she expressed herself?
Boy, I don't know. I know that, yeah, she didn't ever blow up at me, and I think she trusted me, and I think she saw me as an ally. But I don't know if that was different from how she was with her. I know I think she felt that way about her siblings as well. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it was just me.
So
her parents got the brunt of it, unfortunately.
That was where I was going. She certainly treated you differently from her parents. All right. So when did she confide, or did she ever confide in you about her bulimia, or was this something you learned from her parents and then had a conversation with her?
Yeah, she never really came forward and told me about it. It just kind of, I don't know, I ended up knowing about it probably through a letter from her mom referring to it or something like that. And, you know, Michelle was not particularly secretive at a certain point about it. In fact, she was almost, you know, defiantly outward about her bulimia, as I talk about in the book. It was like her shield against a life and a mental disposition that she felt, you know, out of control with. And so, like her shield was almost, her bulimia was almost like a defense mechanism, I've come to think.
Right, and you describe the circumstances of it, how her parents really got tired of hearing the click of the lock in the bathroom door as she went into vomit.
No.
So it was just that well known in the family, and that idea of it as a shield, though. I mean, anybody who's never been bulimic would certainly struggle to understand that. But she, it sounded like it gave her comfort.
It was very much a devil's bargain, because she was oppressed by it like any addiction. You know, you are oppressed by it, you're enslaved to it, and yet it gives you a certain sense of, you know, I don't know, comfort in the ritual of it, or this is something you can control. I hesitate to say too much because I've never been bulimic, but it definitely was a two-sided coin.
Right. The level of it is pretty shocking, though, when you describe at one point where she was, I think she quit college and went to go work as an au pair in New York and spent all of her money on buying the sweetest, goppiest foods she could find and would wolf them all down and then barf them all back up again.
So let's
talk about what happened. She did finish high school, went off to college. I mean, did she have any more luck making friends as she got into a new environment?
No, I don't think so. I have some of her journals from that first year in college in the book, and she was very, very lonely, and her bulimia, and part of how she dealt with that was the bulimia.
Alice Talmadge, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her memoir of her niece, Michelle, and her early death to suicide is contained in the book Now I Can See the Moon, a story of social panic, false memories, and a life cut short. Let's come back to the false memories. You cite two cases that really set a prairie fire elsewhere, far from where Michelle was in Logan, Utah. Can you lay out the stories of Marianne Barber in Bakersfield and Michelle Smith and the doctor who took her case public in British Columbia?
Well, there were two cases. Marianne Barber was one, and then I don't remember the name of the other, but they were from Southern California. And both of these women were later found to be very emotionally unbalanced and disturbed, but they came to believe that their grandchildren, or in one case their son in another case, could have been sexually abused by a family member. And their obsession with this and kind of linked up with this more this cultural awakening to the frequency, the prevalency of sexual abuse. And at the time, the culture did not know how to interview kids. It did not know the signs of sexual abuse. And what happened was it just set in motion all this machinations and these groups and these personalities that started producing a lot of paranoia and rumor. And then that led to also in Southern California, the McMartin preschool case, where at one point you had, I don't know, hundreds of supposed victims and these child care workers who, you know, didn't know what hit them.
You mentioned being sort of peripherally aware of the McMartin preschool case. It was not something you were focusing on at the time. Did you focus more on some of the wide social panic about ritual sexual abuse once this was something Michelle had talked about?
Well, you know, I didn't realize that they were all part of the same panic. That was kind of you start off on telling a story and then you start researching it, and then it just becomes this incredibly tangled piece of information, and it just got more and more involved. The panic affected different communities differently. The heavily Mormon communities in Utah and southern Idaho, for whatever reason, got caught up in the ritual abuse phenomenon. Other communities got caught up in the childcare aspect of it, thinking that these childcare workers had severely abused these children. And then tangential to that was this the multiple personality disorder diagnoses that were part of it. And then this belief in recovered memories, this whole theory that a lot of people were carrying around memories of abuse that they had, but they weren't able to access them, and it was affecting their lives in the present day. So it was, I knew about the McMartin trial, but I didn't think it had anything to do with my niece. I mean, to me, it was apples and oranges, two different parts of my life. And then to have to discover that they were actually linked, all under the rubric of this social panic, was part of my discovery as I was writing the book.
Right. A lot of things discovered years after Michelle was gone from the planet. The book is called Now I Can See the Moon, A Story of Social Panic, False Memories, and A Life Cut Short. Alice Talmadge writing about her niece, Michelle, gone for about 25 years now. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Alice and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Alice Talmadge, a journalist living in the Springfield area, got her master's degree from the U of O, has taught at the U of O as well, spent a stint as a correspondent for the Oregonian. She turns her attention to her family, specifically to one family member, her long-gone niece, Michelle, who committed suicide in the 90s, early 90s. Her book, Alice Talmadge's book about Michelle, is called Now I Can See the Moon, A Story of Social Panic, False Memories, and A Life Cut Short. If you want to add something to the conversation, join us by phone at 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking about this social panic then and the inability you had at the time to connect what was going on with Michelle and her claims of sexual abuse by some sort of satanic cult to similar stories around the country. Since a lot of these cases turned out where the memories were false, but it has often been described as, have you ever tried to unring a bell? When someone is accused of something as serious as sexual abuse, the taint tends to stay. So what happened to some of these people who were accused falsely?
Well, initially, almost all of those accused in the daycare cases were convicted and sentenced to sometimes, three life sentences. I mean, just exorbitant amounts of time. And what was disturbing in going back and looking at it is that there were no evidence. There was no evidence that was ever found in any of these accusations. The material that was used to accuse them came from interviews with supposed child victims. And as we know now, the way that the children were interviewed and the pressure that was put on them was to accuse their teachers or these childcare workers of things that they knew didn't happen. And some of these kids were really young, 4, 5, 6 years old. And so almost all of those convictions were overturned in the ensuing years, once kind of sanity returned to the culture. But I have to say, a couple in Austin, Texas, they were only fully exonerated last year, 2017. So it's just a horrible miscarriage of justice. In other situations, people have come up to me who have told me, oh my God, this happened in my family. One family member accused another of sexual abuse, and in some cases, it just split the family, and the accused or one of the parties died, and the family never was able to come to a resolution. In some situations, people retracted the accusations. Jeff, this is really hard because what I learned when I wrote my book about sex offenders, and I think it's true whether they're juvenile or adult, is denial is the first response of an actual perpetrator. No,
sure.
Nobody wants to admit this. And so you've got you've got that truth, and then you've got the truth of someone who's unjustly accused. So it's very, very tricky territory. Very tricky territory.
Yeah, the minefield I described at the outset, for sure. Yeah, there's an email here from James, no town given. He says, I read a book in the early 80s called Michelle Remembers. The visions she had seemed straight out of the Middle Ages and the Inquisition. So that's an observation from James, which you know makes me wonder, as the more we talk about this, the more I'm reminded of things like when people got into earlier societies and got concerned about witches among them. Did you find parallels there?
Yes, I mean, sociologists who've studied the 1980s social panic or folklorists will tell you that this is a recurring theme, you know, throughout humanity, Western civilization. You know, it started the Roman age, you know, and whatever group was the out group were the ones who were in league with Satan. So it was either Christians, sometimes it was Jews, dark-skinned people, whatever, whoever was the out group. And if you read, Stacy Schiff wrote an incredible book about the Salem witchcraft trials, and some of the comments that she makes or observations or the things that people say, you could just pick them up and put them right in the middle of the mid-1980s. it was the same kind of paranoia. And I just want to add that I talk about the book Michelle Remembers in my book because it was one of the books that my sister-in-law encouraged me to read, and she said, you know, Michelle's not the only one. And Michelle Remembers was published in 1980. It's since been declared a fraud, but at the time, nobody knew that. And people also consider that as a template for a lot of these reports that supposed victims of ritual abuse ended up saying had happened to them. So, yes.
So you mentioned Mary giving you the book Michelle Remembers, and you know, saying this is the.
Told me about it, and I found it in the
library.
Okay,
sure. All right. So, I guess the question I want to come back to Michelle and the Michelle you know, and talk about the kind of help she got. I mean, as she developed bulimia, and as there were other outbursts of imbalance, what kind of help did her family seek for her, and did she accept?
She went to counseling. She had therapists, and I talked to one of the counselors, and he did what he could, and you know clearly cared about her. But as I also talk about in the book, her last couple of counselors also believed in the ritual abuse narrative, which I don't think did her any favors.
So we talked about how she quit college and went to New York, and her bulimia got even worse. You talked to her very directly while you were on a visit to Utah, and she was there. What did you say to her?
Well, I remember I told her about a book I had read, I don't know, The Little Unicorn or something, and I don't know, the gist of what I said to her is whatever is at the bottom of this, you need to turn around and face it and not resort to bulimia to keep it at bay, whatever it is. And, you know, I look back and I just had no idea how complicated her mindset was and how ridiculous I must have sounded to her. But, I didn't know how much I didn't know at the time.
Right. Yeah, so hindsight is great from this distance. How did she respond to that conversation?
Well, she was like tolerant, and I think I say it's like an old person responds to a young person who says they're there, you know, it's going to be okay, when they have no idea what the older person has withstood in their life and what it feels like to be facing, you know, their eventual demise and things like that. I mean, she was just kind of patient and polite, but you don't get it.
Yeah. Did her behavior escalate? I mean, the bulimia, as you mentioned, was just sort of, you know, always there, at least in the background, not gone for good ever. But did she get more outwardly destructive as well?
Yes. Yeah. There were incidences where John and Mary would come home and, as they said it, you know, everything that was made of glass in the house was smashed, including, you know, the TV set and picture frames and, I don't know, dishware. You know, she just, she acted out. And that's what put her in the hospital, I think, the first time. And then, but I would, probably most of the destruction was inward. It was towards herself in the form of bulimia. She also did some self-harming.
And she broke the glass because she didn't want to see her reflection. Was that it?
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, that it's metaphorical in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You could see it that way. Also, she was desperate. She needed attention, but she didn't know how to. She didn't know what she needed the attention for. She wanted this thing to stop. She wasn't in control of it. Yeah.
You mentioned later in the book that there was a possibility that this was borderline personality disorder. I know in talking to people in the mental health field here, we talk about the importance of diagnosis. Do you feel like she ever really got the right one?
No. No. And I don't think she was, I don't know that they had, you know, we're always in process as far as treating mental illness. Mm-hmm. We still don't completely understand it. Perhaps there were medications then that would have helped, but she wouldn't take them, and her system was so messed up. I don't think they were in her system long enough to take effect. I just think she slipped through the cracks. You know, people tried, but she was a very difficult case.
Indeed.
And when she got caught up in the ritual abuse, the flashbacks and the memories, I'm not sure anything could have brought her out of it. She was so entangled in that narrative and in those flashbacks.
If I've got the timeline right, before she started talking about the flashbacks of the ritual abuse, she wrote to you after a bit of a silence of being raped in New York City.
Actually, it wasn't in New York City. It was a rape that occurred when she was in middle school.
Oh.
In her hometown of Logan.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was very difficult because I got that letter, and then it was a couple months later that I met up with her, and she told me about the ritual abuse memories, the flashbacks, and so the two things seemed to, they got jumbled up in her mind, in her journals even. It was hard to know which offense she was referring to. And initially I believed what she said and about the gang rape, and now I guess where I've settled is that something happened. I'm not sure what.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I think something happened because she had a later accusation that was totally baseless.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, there's just, as I said, there's that whole belief, unbelief.
Sure, sure. But, you know, but you, the writing in your book, when you talk about Michelle talking to you about the ritual or the flashbacks, your writing is really effective. You tell us about it's the reaction of a person whose mind has been blown and can only latch on to the things that they know. Like you hear the birds chirping in the trees,
yeah.
But then you've got these words coming out of Michelle's mouth. I mean, how, if at all, were you processing what she was telling you?
Well, as I said, it was just like you go into shock because here's this person, you know, who's your friend slash peer. You love them. You want to protect them. You want to believe them, but they are saying something that is so out of, I was so unable to even imagine it that it was a big, what do they call that, cognitive dissonance.
Right.
I just kind of went on automatic pilot.
So her parents reported what she had told them to the police. What did the police do with the information?
They reported the what Michelle told them about the gang rape, but it had been several years, and Michelle was very vague as to identities and when it happened and where and all of that. And they perhaps made inquiries, but and John made his own, but nothing of substance.
So helping understand then as Michelle was hospitalized later in life and things just continued to spiral downward, was it before she was gone that you began to question her story and began to, I mean, you compare it to the other stories going on around the country, reports of ritual sexual abuse that turned out not to be true?
I didn't know. I mean, even though I read the newspaper reports, I was really so focused on her that I didn't do comparative thinking. Oh boy, it's hard for me to admit this, but I tried to keep a piece of me open you know, maybe some of this happened. But I would say like 95% of me was absolutely not. But the what if would kind of creep up at night, and it was just so disturbing because it didn't match with anything going on in my immediate life or anything that was around me. In Utah, it did. That narrative had more credibility, but here in Oregon, it didn't as much. And so, but after she died and after I started, you know, poking around, I was able to appreciate that she was not alone in what she was reporting, and to appreciate just how widespread this whole narrative became at that time.
I can feel that sense of like, you know, the stuff that gnaws on you in the middle of the night. Ultimately, this is a story you had to tell, I gather.
Yeah, it took me long enough, but I was kind of overwhelmed and intimidated by the subject matter. And as I write in the book, I didn't want to write the book. I just resisted it and resisted it. I didn't like the topic. I thought it was icky. The ick factor was huge. And then it just became so entangled and so complicated. The whole recovered memory issue of itself is still very, very controversial, and it was just like, you know, opening a, you know, a snake pit. But yes, I guess I felt I had to finish it.
Do you feel a sense of liberation now that it's out?
Yes.
Right. And thank you for sharing it with us. The book is called, and is this Michelle's picture on the cover of the book?
Yes, it is.
Now I Can See the Moon is the story of Michelle as told by Alice Talmadge of Springfield, subtitled A Story of Social Panic, False Memories, and A Life Cut Short. Alice, thank you so much for sharing the story with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, take care.